very much for the introduction. The only part that might be incorrect, that may not answer the question. I mean, more raising the question. So this is sort of recent things. This is some of my recent papers on this. Actually, this one's now out, but I didn't. Sorry, I made this transparency for talk of it, so anyway, it's easy to find. I should warn out that this is very controversial. I sent this to FISREV Letters, and they had two referees that didn't like anthropic principle, and they didn't like it, so I appealed it. And just today, I printed out for Monday's thing the latest referees. So this is a warning. The first one says, to be honest, I think this paper is silly. It sets up several logical straw men and then proceeds to a ridiculous conclusion. None of it can be tested. None of it has any consequences for experiment, observation, or astrophysics theory. So you're warm. Now, the second referee is a little more positive. I won't read all of the 4.5 pages he writes. But he did say, I think this is an interesting paper with some additions and changes that could be published. It's not that time urgent wise because it's already attracting attention from its archive preprint, and I think it's important to be part of the record of the physics literature. I dismissed the previous two referees' reports. I think those referees do not realize how important the Boltzmann brain problem is. So anyway, so it's a controversial topic, and let me proceed to... Okay, so there are different ways to raise the basic question, and one way to raise it maybe is, why is the universe comprehensible? I mean, Einstein as well, the owner, is supposed to have said that the most incomprehensible thing about the world, that it is comprehensible. Now, of course, you can answer different levels, a philosophical, theological level. As an evangelical Christian, I might say, well, the universe is created by an omniscient God who comprehends fully, and he created humans in his image to comprehend partially. But, of course, we'd like to understand scientifically this. So how do observers within the universe have ordered observations and comprehensions of the universe? How is it that we within the universe can comprehend something about it? And the threat is, as we will see from vacuum fluctuation observers, that probably would be highly disordered and not seeing have any comprehensible view. So we'll talk about different kinds of observers. I'll abbreviate that there's ordinary observers, or OOs for short, and Lindy referred to them as honest folk like ourselves. Well, he also said they could have the prerogative of doing something drastic to the universe or something. He didn't think Boltzmann brains could destroy the universe, but honest folk like ourselves maybe could. So,
anyway. That's a criterion for honesty.
So the idea is that they arise from some equilibrium process, like Darwinian evolution by natural selection, or however we got here. And, you know, we don't know the full details, but you might think it's a reasonable fraction of those might be expected to have ordered observations, memories, and comprehensions, because there was the history. We live in this world. Well, there are things called Boltzmann brains, and these go back to a paper. Andy was one of the first to use the name in the literature. But the idea goes back to Boltzmann in Nature 51. It was suggested by his assistant, Dr. Schutz. And I'll just take time to read his. Boltzmann was on a paper, certain questions of the theory of gases and so on. But then he says, I'll conclude with this paper with the idea of my old assistant, Dr. Schutz. We assume that the whole universe is and rests forever in thermal equilibrium. The probability that only one part of the universe is in a certain state is the smaller, the farther this state is from thermal equilibrium. But this probability is greater, the greater is the universe itself. If we assume the universe great enough, we can make the probability of one relatively small part being in any given state, however far from the state of thermal equilibrium, as great as we please. We can also make the probability great that, though the whole universe is in thermal equilibrium, our world is in its present state. It may be said that the world is so far from thermal equilibrium that we cannot imagine the improbability of such a state. But can we imagine, on the other side, how small a part of the whole universe this world is? Assuming the universe great enough, the probability that such a small part of it is our world should be in its present state is no longer small. If this assumption were correct, our world would return more and more to thermal equilibrium. But because the whole universe is so great, it might be probable that at some future time, some other world might deviate as far from thermal equilibrium as our world does at present. Thus, the aforementioned H-curve would form a representation of what takes place in the universe. The summits of the curve would represent the worlds where visible motion and life exist. So that was the quote from the thing. So the idea, well, in this, for my talk here, it's not that the whole, it's not necessarily that the whole universe is a thermal, is some equilibrium, is some fluctuation, but that brains are the something that, that can make observations, or might be brains. So they might be thermal or vacuum fluctuations. So now we would expect that if you did a thermal fluctuation to something like a brain, I mean, most cases probably the brain wouldn't be connected upright. It probably only a very tiny fraction would give consciousness that you would actually be aware of making an observation. Then of these, a very tiny fractionation would have ordered observations that they would, I'll put in quotes, that they would think that they were aware of something having degree of order. And even of those, nearly all of them would be illusions because most of the fluctuations would just produce this brain, but the surroundings would not be at all what the brain might think it was, even if the brain did think it. The surrounding sense. Then if you wanted to require further conditions on this brain, a very tiny fraction of these might give ordered observations of, say, galaxy-galaxy correlations or something that we might want to measure. But then even of the tiny fraction that see this, only a very small fraction of those would give a galaxy-galaxy correlation similar to what we see. So I mean, here you can substitute any measurement of anything you want that we make. So, and of course, even in these, most of them would be illusions, and a very tiny fraction of them would be non-illusory.
I don't follow those last two points.
That
any fraction has a real universe.
Pardon? Okay, I'm saying is that there's only a very tiny fraction of possible brain states that would lead to consciousness. Only a tiny fraction of those would give ordered observations. Only a tiny fraction of those would give ordered observations of this in particular.
Say, it says, would even conceive that there's such a thing as a galaxy and think that they have some particular value for the correlations.
Right, right. Wow. And an even tinier fraction would actually, even if they did think they were seeing galaxy-galaxy correlations, a very tiny fraction of them are likely to see ones similar to what we see.
I don't get.
So maybe, what part about it you don't get?
Are they going to look at the same galaxies we are?
Pardon?
No, they're not the last one.
They're not taking, this is just produced by, they're not actually seeing anything. It's just a brain that's fluctuated into a state that it thinks it sees something.
It's completely solipsistic until you get to the last line.
So what I'm saying, it's much easier to have a brain fluctuate existence than a whole surroundings of galaxies. So most of these cases, the brain thinks it's seeing something and there really isn't anything out.
So, supposing there is some effect that's non-illusory, such as the, cosmic microwave background.
Right.
As long as they're able to conceive of it and measure it, won't they get the cosmic microwave background? I mean, why would a fluctuation giving you an illusory cosmic microwave background be more likely than...
Because there's no real cosmic microwave background. It's just a brain sitting there.
Even if there would the background there, if just the brain just fluctuated into existence, and this might happen in a fraction of a second, for example. So if the brain fluctuated existence in a fraction of a second, there would be no reason to suppose that the information into that brain got into it in the normal way. It got there just purely because of this extremely improbable vacuum fluctuation.
I guess I missed the premise.
So the premise is, for this part, Boltzmann brains, for this part, I'm just talking about just assuming the brain itself fluctuated into existence. And it didn't get there by any evolutionary process. It didn't even get there by existing there an hour ago. So that's why I'm saying. If you have questions, ask, because I mean the big part of this is the conceptual part, and at least I'd like to get, I mean there's real controversy when you get later. This part I think if it could be explained, hopefully isn't too controversial. But
what you're really trying to say is that if somebody is lying to us and dreaming us up in a dream, it is a very complex dream indeed.
Yes, yeah, it'd have to be a very complex dream. I mean, it's not...
I think the only controversial part is that people abandon this worry because they say, well, obviously we're not really in equilibrium. And then you can kind of sweep this under the rug. But if you... It's not clear what you replace it with, and if you think there was equilibrium, you are stuck with this. I think think.
Right.
So I think that part is uncontroversial.
But the evolutionary thing is, I think, what more of us tend to think happened, right?
Yeah.
There really was a...
Right. So these are flaws.
Collapse and,
yeah.
and so forth and so on, you know, so...
So it's an inconsistency in many theories that you might try to have as theories of cosmology.
Yeah, so that's what I'm pointing out is that I don't believe we're bolted brains. And I'm saying that the first part was trying to give very strong evidence that we're not. And, well, this slide too. But then what I'll say that in various ways of interpreting modern theories, it seems like you're in danger of the theory predicting that almost all brains are. So I'm saying it's a potential problem for some theories. So that's... Okay, so this is the argument about that we should expect ourselves to be not extremely unusual in our class. So Copernican principle, we're not spatially privileged. We get anthropic principle, what we observe is conditioned upon our existence as observers. Then Vilenkin and the principle of mediocrity, that we're a typical civilization. And Nick Bostrom has a nice book on anthropic bias, observation selection effects of science philosophy, and he argues... One should reason as if one's present observer moment were a random sample from the set of all observer moments in its reference class. So I might say something very similar, and not completely coincidentally use the initials of my wife, Kathy Ann Page's, for my obscure conditional esthemic principle. Unless one has compelling contrary evidence, one should reason as if one's conscious perception were a random sample from the set of all conscious perceptions. That's almost the same as that. The only difference is what he calls observer moments, I call conscious perception. All of it you're aware of at once, I call that. And he has the slight hedge that he allows the reference class to be somewhat restricted, but not too much. Whereas I would think that in principle, you should allow all conscious perceptions into this game. So the idea from this, of course, is that we wouldn't be a random sample if most brains were actually Boltzmann brains, if by far most brains are not Boltzmann brains rather than ordinary brains. So now let's use this to analyze theories. So let's have two classes of theories we'll call ordinary observer theories, or OOTs, and Boltzmann brain theories, or BBTs. So in the first theory, class of theories, the ordinary observers would give a fraction or measure of order one of all observations, observer moments, or conscious perceptions. I'm not necessarily saying it has to be the most. It wouldn't upset me too greatly if only, say, 1% of all observations were you know, ordinary observers with ordered things and 99% with the other, because I'd say, well, that's a 1% chance. So 1% chance I'm not worried about. But if it's a chance of 10 to the minus 100, then I am worried. I mean, if there's only 10 to the minus, if a theory says there's only a chance of 10 to the minus 100 of my getting the observation I get, I think that's bad news for the theory. If it's 1%, well, it's somewhat bad for the theory, but maybe not too bad. So, well, even here I'll be even more conservative. Let's say order 1 means order 10 to the, bigger than 10 to the minus 10. So, and so then under this, I would say, okay, for these as ordinary observers, and let's suppose that indeed of the ordinary observers, given the conditions that they measure the galaxy-galaxy correlation, or they have an awareness of having apparently observed it, that they would get a galaxy-galaxy correlation similar to what we get, then I would say, okay, then that would, you might expect that to be of order one. I mean, that might be the case. Okay, in Boltzmann brain theories, the Boltzmann brains give nearly all observations, so ordinary observers give a fraction or measure much less than one. Say, and let's say, for being conservative, let's say that they give less than that. So then, given a Boltzmann brain theory, the probability that an observation is ordered would be much less than 10 to the minus 10. And similarly, even if you conditioned upon ones that are sufficiently ordered to think they had galaxy-galaxy correlations, the chance that it would be of the detail of ours has, or the particular structure of ours has, would presumably also be very tiny. So then what you could do is you can use this in Bayes' theorem to say, suppose you wanted, given that we have ordered observations, what's the probability of a Boltzmann brain theory? Well, you do have to have prior probabilities. The prior probability that before you made any, considered the observations, what's the prior probability of the Boltzmann brain theory and the ordinary one? Well, then you get the probability of the Boltzmann-Brain's theory times the probability of the ordered and the Boltzmann-Brain theory. In other words, the joint probability that it's Boltzmann-Brain and that it's ordered divided by the total probability for getting ordered observations. So then that's, there's two ways to get ordered observations, either with a Boltzmann-Brain or with an ordinary observer. And the idea that is that, of course, that this would be much bigger than this, than this piece, and so unless the probability of the ordinary observer theory is much less than this, I mean, you could compensate, of course, by having this very tiny to be much less than this factor, for example, then the denominator is going to be dominated by this. It's going to be much bigger than the numerator. It'd be much less than one. So unless you just had some very strong reason to favor a theory in which you had the Boltzmann-Brain theory, then after seeing our ordered observation, we would conclude that most likely the correct theory of the world predicts that most observers are not Boltzmann-Brains. Again, this prior thing goes into the thing that, you know, if we were absolutely certain of a theory that did predict that almost all of the brains were Boltzmann brains, if we were absolutely sure of that, then we'd have to live with it. And then we'd say, well, we're some giant fluke. But the point is, it'd probably be somewhat perverse to have to say a theory that we're just absolutely sure that Boltzmann brains dominate. So
this is a formal way of saying we have to be crazy to believe Boltzmann-Brain theory.
Sort of, yeah, sorry.
Which is,
I don't know.
More intuitive.
I don't know. I'm not sure you know.
We really have no evidence that we aren't the only OOs in the universe.
Yeah, so I'm not saying how many ordinary observers there are, whether we're the only ones or not. I mean, I'm not sure that's relevant for this directly. Maybe it is later. We'll see. But
it could be that the prior is, or OOT is very small.
Well, it could. I mean, it could be. Well, I mean, but I'm saying if it's very small and compared to Boltzmann-Brain theories,
I'm asking, what if it's less likely for real consciousness to evolve and exist than it is for Boltzmann-Brains to achieve this level?
Yeah. Well, it depends on the theory. But I'm saying when you get back to the ultimate theory, since we don't know which theory is the correct theory of the universe. When we try to evaluate, we try to use the evidence, the observational evidence we have, to give probabilities. So after using the evidence, the probabilities we assign are called posterior probabilities. And in Bayes' analysis, the way you do it is that you assign a prior probability to the theory before you consider the observations. And then you use the likelihoods. In other words, given a theory, what's the probability of making the observation? And then you use this Bayesian analysis to say what your posterior probability should be. And I'm just emphasizing,
utterly dependent on the prior.
Yeah, it certainly depends on the prior. So that way, you know, but most of the time in physics we tend to think, you know, the simpler priors are more likely, and even though we can never prove that Maxwell's equations are always true over our part of the universe, I mean, we tend to favor theories in which it is, even though, of course, we can't prove it. You could choose a prior probability so that Maxwell's theory is not right, but then just say it's a giant fluke that we see it to be right whenever we test it, for example. So
it's almost like using the principle of mediocrity to guess that the probability prior for OOT is not as tiny as the
Well, I'm not sure we can do anything with the prior here, but I'm just saying I don't see any obvious reason why we would put the prior to be so much smaller. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't know yet enough, but I mean, the prior is, I think, subjective, but we do in science tend to favor simpler priors. Mm-hmm. So it could be, if we really found that of all the possible theories, all the simple ones were dominated by Boltzmann-Brains, and we were absolutely sure there weren't any simple theories at all that had ordinary observers dominate, then we might shift them. I mean, then it might be even posterior. We might think the Boltzmann-Brain theory dominate. Okay, so now I want to raise the question, well, would an everlasting universe be a Boltzmann-Brain theory? Now, if you had a finite volume, so here by finite spatial volume, so we have a finite spatial volume universe, and let's suppose it's one ordinary observers last a finite time. So, for example, suppose we're dependent upon the sun, as our present conditions, we certainly do. And suppose that you can't, ordinary observers can't last too much longer than the stars, or at least there's not very many of them. So that there's only a finite number of ordinary observers within this finite spatial volume. But if the universe then lasted forever, then you could presumably have vacuum fluctuations producing these brains arbitrarily late into the future. So you could have, if you integrate over all time, you could have an arbitrarily large number of these things. They could fluctuate into existence and out, make their observation and disappear, and so on. And so there would be presumably an infinite number of these. So this would then be a Boltzmann brain theory. Yes, your friend.
Is it necessary that there's an infinite number? I mean, if you just have a highly expanding universe, it's going to cool down, thermal fluctuations are going to drop.
Well, I'm assuming that vacuum fluctuations can do it. So anytime, so there'd be, I'm assuming there's some non-zero, maybe tiny, but non-zero probability per four volume of producing one. And I'm just saying if it lasts forever, the four volume goes to infinity, so you multiply infinity times any tiny number. Well, it's not that the probability, you have e to the minus something or other if it doesn't happen. But the expected number of these would be the probability per four volume times the four volume. So if the four volume goes to infinity, the expected number per four volume is bigger than zero, then you get infinite number. So you get an infinite number of Boltzmann brains if the universe could last forever.
So I guess I don't see why you couldn't get ordinary observers, some made in one epoch, some made in another epoch, and thereby create an infinite number of those as well.
Yeah, so, okay, so by this, when O's last a finite time, I mean, all of them. I don't mean necessarily each one of them. So I am assuming, which I would say seems plausible for if our universe expands and the stars burn out and you no longer have stars and everything cools down, it seems very unlikely that ordinary observers would last more than, there might be decaying. There might be some tiny probability, but the probability of an ordinary observer would presumably decay off exponentially at very late time. So I don't see it's very plausible if the three volume were fixed and if the universe keeps expanding forever that ordinary observers would keep on existing in that. Although we can talk about that may be related to the fact if the universe fluctuates and we got another Big Bang or something.
Yeah. Right, yeah. So I think you're really assuming a certain picture of the universe when you think that.
Yeah, so we'll go on to that. So the first part is just that if they do, and by I don't mean necessarily each one individually, but the whole set of them only lasts a finite time. And that then you would get this. Now, okay, so you could have, there's other problems if you can regenerate, and I'll talk about that later too. For infinite volume universe, if the universe is inflated an infinite amount, which is suggested in many pictures of internal inflation, then, of course, you have infinite spatial volume, so you presumably, if the probability per planet, say, is bigger than zero, and you have an infinite number of planets, there's presumably an infinite number of ordinary observers, as well as. So then, unfortunately, you get an ambiguous ratio of infinity divided by infinity, so it's not quite clear whether it's an OOT or a BB on there. So this is one of the big problems in cosmology today. So eternal inflation picture of Lindy, Blenken, Starobinsky, and others seems to predict an infinite volume universe. So how to regulate these infinities to predict ratios of observations is the major problem. It's a huge problem in present theoretical cosmology. How do you, if the universe is predicted to likely be infinite size, how do you actually take ratios of things? Well, Lindy and Blenken have suggested measures in which the ordinary observers dominate. So there might be slew. I'm not sure I have a strong criticism against these, but they don't look ordinarily natural to me. There's one review of this maybe suggests that they aren't extremely natural. So I would say it's an open question and. That's why I sort of want to raise this analysis. I mean, I'm not saying it's impossible, but I'm saying it's not.
How does one define the natural universe given?
I'm not sure. In my minds, I guess I would mean simple. So, I mean, simple, elegant, beautiful.
You mean just in terms of the length of the algorithm that it takes you to calculate?
Yeah, maybe that's something like that. Something like there, yeah, there's a big question about what does simplicity mean, and I circle around some people some argument against Dawkins' business about the God delusion, about assumptions, and that even David Deutsch responded that even simplicity depends upon, well, it depends on your background knowledge, and for thus living in the universe, it depends on the laws of physics, and therefore he said how complicated things are depends upon the laws of physics. So there's a big question. I mean, there's that I don't really want to focus on today, but there is a big question about how do you define simplicity or naturalism.
Even mathematically, this answer, maybe we can define it in algorithmic information and associated with the algorithm, the culprits.
Yeah, you could do that, but what I might point out, just to say that's not clear, is of course the algorithm depends on what background knowledge the computer has. Unfortunately, for finite length things, I mean, if you go to infinite length things and your computer is finite length, then you can compare. But if you have just two finite length algorithms, it depends what background knowledge the computer has.
I guess it must be Turing machines. Anyway,
that's a whole other.
Yeah, so it's a whole. There's other ambiguity. I mean, it's related to this question of prior. Well, there's a lot of other ambiguities there too. Okay, so here's one regularization that I suggest seems sort of natural. But I'm going to say it leads to problems. So I'm not necessarily going to advocate this, but at least I will show that this is sort of that. So one way is to divide the whole thing, or some people call it multiverse. I made up my own word holocosm because to emphasize that it's a unity of the whole thing. So suppose you divide it up into quasi-classical regions, like bubbles or pocket universes, and that are connected and have nearly constant constants, like lambda, for example, is nearly constant over this regime. And if you had some sort of, so in other words, in this, if you have some quantum transition to an entirely different sort of universe or different bubble, then I'll say you don't go across that transition. You just stick within one connected region of this thing.
So connected refers to the classical space-time.
Yeah, so connected would be like the classical space-time. So, okay, now the different bubbles, I won't say how to weight. I mean, other people have ideas of that. I'm not going to get into that today. So one way that seems natural and is to regulate by co-moving three-volume. So if you had sort of a big bang, now, of course, it's a question of where do you set your T equals zero hypersurface and how you draw your whorl lines that are going to be co-moving. But in some crude sense, you could say, well, we'll do that. We'll have some hypersurface where inflation ended and then take the geodesics orthogonal to that. Regularly. So then if you just have a finite co-moving three volume, then if it's true that the ordinary observers can only exist for a finite time, there'll only be a finite number of them. And by this prescription up here, I'm not allowing to go to the next bubble. I mean, if this bubble has another bubble forming inside of it that does something else, I'm just restricting on a particular one. So then the idea is if the bubble lasts forever, so that the four volume when each co-moving three volume is infinite, you'd expect an infinite number of these BBs because it's a finite number per four volume and infinite. So the ordinary observers being finite would have fraction zero compared to the infinite number. So this would be a BBT that would ruled out by the ordered observations. This is very much analogous to doomsday arguments of Brandon Carter that in 83, and John Lessing wrote a lot about this, and suggesting that unless you have very strong prior probabilities of saying that humans will last far off into the future, then you might say our observations of being, of order 10 to the 11 humans before us, that you might not expect there to be enormously more than 10 to the 11 humans after us. Otherwise, we'd be unusually early in the thing. So similar in this game, I mean, we'd be an unusual, if we were ordinary observers, if there really was infinitely more of the other ones. So this suggests that the universe will decay. Now, I will admit, in my mind, what the biggest uncertainty is this regularization scheme. So you might go to, I'm just saying, this is a natural one that seems to lead to this problem.
What does decay mean?
Decay means that the universe will get destroyed, or it'll collapse. It'll collapse. This quasi-classical regime will end.
There'll be no more humans.
Yeah, there'll be no more humans. There'll be no more space-time. And there might be no more humans just because they die out when the stars die out. But there'll be no more space-time. So it'll end one of these connected quasi-classical regions. So it might tunnel to something else, but as far as this particular one, it will end.
But are you imagining the beginning to the universe? I mean, we're near the beginning, then we'd be more probable in this picture than if the universe happens to be very near its end.
Right, right. So that, yeah, so I mean, we may be within 13 billion years of the beginning, or 14 billion years from the beginning. The end could be further away. Let me discuss how far away the end might be in order to avoid having too many of these Boltzmann brains. So, okay, let's imagine that we have sort of an asymptotically De Sitter model for the observed cosmic acceleration. If it's due to a cosmological constant or dark energy equiescence with this W parameter of pressure over the energy density to -1, so that the energy density, which could be reinterpreted as a cosmological constant, is really constant. Okay, then if you use the data of the Hubble rate and the omega lambda, the fraction of the energy density in this lambda, then the asymptotic logarithmic expansion rate, after the matter and radiation is all thinned out and dark matter is all thinned out, the asymptotic rate will be the reciprocal of somewhere between 14 and 18 gigayears, or 14, 18 billion years. So now, as far as we can see, our part of the universe seems to be very nearly, on the average, spatially flat. So of our observed universe, if today is dominated by lambda and dust, the radiation's become... It's well described by this K equals 0 Friedman-Robinson-Walsh curve metric, which you can write down in this simple form, where the parameter T that goes out sets the scale for the thing is, using that data, it's about 11 plus or minus 1.5 gigayears. And the present value of this dimensionless time parameter tau is the inverse tangent of that. It's about 1 1/4 of that. It's very... It's amusing coincidence that at the present time, the Hubble constant times the age is pretty near 1. I mean, that's basically saying that the universe, as it first expanded at a fast rate and then slowed down and then speeded up, and we happen to be at a point where if you draw a line from there, the present slope pretty much goes back to there within the uncertainties. That's just an interesting coincidence. So if you want to, if you put that in, that would fix the tau naught, and then you could say the age. Well, another amusing thing. It's 100 million years divided by the fine structure constant. So we could just write. We could summarize it as this: with the cold dark matter lambda k equals 0 Friedman Robinson Walker, with the present age equal to the inverse of the present Hubble constant with 10 to the 8 years over alpha. That's just a mnemonic for remembering the present thing. Okay, so suppose, yes.
In order for that to be amusing, 100 million years has to have a special role.
Yeah, so it's not... That's true. It's not, I guess, if 100 million years isn't amusing, then it's not really amusing. I'll admit. Some of these jokes I tell to my wife, and she says, are you really going to say that? should I say another one that she told me not to say?
Yeah. Yeah. We all suffer from the same affliction.
Okay, this is I told him that we could just summarize the my meeting here. It's wait a minute. Bay Area brainers gathered to keep Boltzmann brains at bay. So anyway, she told me not to say it. So
we won't blame her.
Okay, won't blame her. That's right. Okay, so. All right, let's suppose that suppose we have a deterministic decay, that the universe lasts for set time in this model and then decays. It's in the big crash, whatever. So if it lasted until this tau that much bigger than 1, that's just to simplify. So then we can just have the exponential expansion. Decays deterministically. Then the culminating formula it will be because this is very big, I can forget about the prefactors. The four volume will have this form, and if the probability per four volume of vacuum fluctuation BB, let's suppose that the Euclidean action to form this thing is S of E, and let's say that the probability that E to the minus that gives the amplitude, E to the minus 2 times that gives the, so this one in some sense would be half the action of an instanton, I guess it would be just to form it. And so twice that would, so this would be the probability per four volume ignoring prefactors. Then the ratio of Boltzmann brains to ordinary observers, let's suppose we're dominated by the exponential, so the ordinary observers are of order unity compared to this huge exponential, is of order that. So then the idea is this will dominate, of course, if this is big and positive. So if tau is much bigger than that, or t bigger than ten, than that, which order of magnitude, of course, is just the present age. So if the time is much bigger than the action times 10 to the 10th years, then the Boltzmann brains would dominate. Well, in the first published paper that I had about this, they gave it a conference proceeding in Korea. I conservatively assumed that for a brain, you would need maybe 1 kilogram brain to last, say, a tenth of a second. Suppose it took a tenth of a second for an observation. Then the action's around 10 to the 50. So the BBs would dominate if the time was greater than 10 to the 60 years, and I suggested the universe wouldn't last that long. Then in this paper, which is actually out now, sorry, I didn't correct that, I suggested maybe a more realistic requirement is it would seem to me that the brain could observe something instantaneously once it got into the right state. So then I just assumed that you had to have the brain, but it has to be separate from all antimatter by roughly the size of the brain of 30 centimeters. So then if you just say, well, you have to move this 1 kilogram 30 centimeters, then the action is 10 to the 42. And I even put a reference to the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe, which the editors didn't take out, so it's... I think it's even reference 42 in the paper. But anyway, so it's in there. So then it would be 10 to the 42 times that. It would be about 10 to the 52 years would be the time for Boltzmann brains to dominate. So, okay, but then this past fall... it occurred to me that, well, suppose the universe is decaying quantum mechanically, then in some sense you need much more strong requirements on the decay rate. So let's suppose it's decaying quantum mechanically, and let's suppose we have bubble nucleation at a rate of A for annihilation, per four volume. And then once this bubble forms, then it rapidly expands at very near the speed of light and goes off and destroys everything that's within the causal future at this point. So you have a bubble formation, and basically everything to the causal future gets destroyed. So then you can work out that the expectation value of the 4 volume per co-moving 3 volume is infinite, which would lead to an infinite number of BBs, unless the decay rate is bigger than this minimum value, which comes out to be that. Now, in Planck units, of course, that's a very tiny number, e to the minus 563. But this is saying that the idea is that, of course, if the universe because it's probabilistic, if the universe isn't decaying fast enough, then the volume is growing because it's growing exponentially. And so basically you have to have the decay rate fast enough to beat this exponential growth rate in the 3 volume as a function of time in order that the integrated expectation value of the 4 volume stays finite. So if you put this, it suggests that the universe is decaying at what I call an astronomical rate because it corresponds to the cosmological time scale rather than the quantum occurrence time scale. Now, of course, this is a slight reverse. I mean, normally astronomical you think big and compared to human lengths, whereas in this for the rate, of course, an astronomical time is big compared to human time. An astronomical rate, of course, is very small compared to human time scales. But on the other hand, it's very big compared to the inverse of this, the quantum recurrence time scale, time scale is this, the rate would be the inverse of that. Okay, then you can calculate survival probability up to some time, given from the beginning to the end of this thing, and you can say, okay, that if you put in, you know, A equal to the minimum value, the present rate of decay of the universe would be, from this, would be more than 10 to the minus 11 per year. So if you multiply that by the number of humans on Earth, you'd have a death rate of 7 per century. Now, of course, it's not 7 people dying in 1 century. It's all 7 billion people dying with a chance of 1 in a billion in a century. So then you can also calculate, go up to that and find out where would the P of T, T naught plus that, be a half what the present probability is, and that you get a half-life of a bit less than 19 gigayears. Well, it's the same. It's just this number, the order of magnitude is constants coming in. So this would suggest that if the universe really is expanding exponentially, and if the decay is only probabilistic, then the decay rate itself has to be this astronomical thing. It has to correspond to this cosmological time scale rather than these much bigger time scales that had gotten before. Okay, so that's...
Oh, is it necessary that the decay be quantum mechanical, though?
Well, I don't know. I guess anything you could say that's probabilistic in some sense. Well, I suppose it implicitly does require something like Everett Many Worlds, and that I really want the cases in which the universe doesn't decay to actually give observers. And I want to say that out of that whole ensemble, ours are, I don't know, if it's really a stochastic process, I might have to rethink what I mean. In some sense, well, I guess you could still say it would be improbable. It would be improbable for us to see what we see, because it would be most probable that the universe would last, even though the probability is tiny for it to last very long, there'd be so many observers that if you take the expected number of Boltzmann brains, then it would be infinite, whereas we're finite.
Presumably the key to this decay is that it resets the clock. I mean, if you decay and keep getting more BBs, that doesn't help.
Right, right. So you have to, yeah. So you
got to either be able to produce them in tandem with OOs or not produce anything.
Yeah, so this is, in some sense, resetting clock. And then of course, it depends, which is my way of regularizing, which might not be the correct one, is to say that you only do it within when the clock started, when you had the Big Bang, and when it ends with this decay. So it's true. So I think the real controversial part is this regularization. That's at least my point of view about that. And I agree it's controversial. And here's other problems with the conclusion of my way of regularizing it, is that if there's not only a minimum bound, but there would be a maximum, which I'm only going to estimate really crudely. If the decay rate was more than, say, 1,000 times the minimum rate, so if it was this big, then the decay rate at the present time would be bigger than 8 per gigayear. And so, in other words, the half-life, even if you conditionalized upon the universe lasting this long, the probability would be only half it would last another 90 million years. Well, that also means, roughly speaking, since 90 million is only a small fraction of the age of the universe, roughly 90 million years ago, there would be only a 50% chance it would last till today. So it would then be surprising that we live so late. I mean, in some sense, most probably would have decayed by now. It would be a much higher measure of the universe being at an earlier time, and so most likely, even ordinary observers like us would have been earlier in the universe. So therefore, I would say that observationally this is observationally excluded. I mean, whether or not you believe in a Boltzmann brains or not, I would think that this sort of thing is observationally excluded. But then if I also do propose that there's this minimum rate, then as A has to be within this range, well, it's three orders of magnitude of 10 and a range of roughly 7 for E. But still, as far as the exponent goes, it's fairly narrow. So, for example, if you use one proposed mechanism for the decay, as given by this paper, they suggest that a decay rate could be given by the mass of the gravity. Well, there's an order one factor that has to do with relative heights of vacua and so on. In there, I'll just leave out. Then, if they had an exponential rate like this, then if I wanted it to be within these limits, then this gravitino mass, or this slightly normalized gravitino, would have to be within this. Well, the value is not so unusual. It's not, I mean, we don't have any strong evidence that it's not within that range, but it's a very narrow range. It's only about 0.6% of the allowed, 6% of this, or 0.6% of that. So it seems like it would require, you know, fine-tuning to get that in there. Also, you might say, well, maybe that fine-tuning happens in our universe, but if it happens in our bubble or region of the universe, it would seem likely that there would be other bio-friendly bubbles that would have smaller values. I mean, you could say, well, maybe by chance ours happened to be, but if other ones had smaller values, then they would give an infinite number of BBs per co-moving volume, and it would seem that at least if you compared them with ours, and if somehow those kinds of bubbles were not suppressed strongly compared to our kind, then the infinite number per co-moving volume of those would swamp the finite number of ordinary observers in our region, and thus leading to a BBT theory statistically different from what we observe. So
the suggestive mind does have, you know, naturalness problems. It seems like you have to do fine-tuning to get to this. Okay, so as a result of this, I mean, other people have suggested different resolutions of this problem, and so, in fact, shortly after my paper came out, Busso and Freevogel wrote this. I haven't updated to see what the published version is. But they suggested that you, instead of restricting to co-moving three-volume, restrict to a local view within the causal patch of one whirl line. So if you have a whirl line going from here to here, say this is Big Bang, Big Crunch, then you just take whatever's to the future of some point in the whirl line into the past of some other point, and that forms what's called the causal diamond. And then the three volume doesn't grow exponentially. It does, I mean, if you move this forward, it does grow, it does go to infinity in De Sitter space, but it grows, it doesn't grow exponentially. It just grows linear with the proper time. So you have a much longer time before the Boltzmann brains would dominate. Well, Linde has also given an argument. He said that he made an analogy. Well, he didn't make the analogy, but his argument was analogous, and this is my way of phrasing it, which I think he agrees with, that this problem is analogous to imaginary humans with a useful phase, say of 100 years, that's to keep me youthful, of ordered observations, and then followed by a senile phase of trillions of years of disordered observations. So suppose you had a world with this. Well, per human, then the disordered observations would dominate, because there's this trillions of years of, and let's suppose the rate of observations is more or less the same between the two. So you'd have trillions of years of disordered observations, which would dominate the observations, which would be sort of like mine, because it's the youthful phase corresponds to ordinary observers, the senile phase would correspond to the Boltzmann brains. But then, in Linde's analogy, he's imagining it's analogous to having the population growing exponentially. So at any given time, there would be so many more useful observers that they would dominate, their observations would dominate over the thing. So that's the that would be his sort of thing. And Vilenkin also had his variant of this. He said the BBs are equilibrium quantum fluctuations, so he said you should lump them in with bubble formation. See, in my scheme, I said when bubble formation happened, that ended this phase of the universe, and so I don't count beyond it. But he said, well, that's also quantum fluctuation, you probably should count both of them. So then you have co-moving three volume, there's only a finite number of BBs produced, but then bubbles produce an infinite number of ordinary observers. So he's saying the ordinary observers dominate. Well, it seems a bit this is analogous to say you could have bubble formation, and then a little bit later, after maybe 14 billion years, you have ordinary observers, and then you have Boltzmann brains over billions of years, but then you could have this bubble formation. And let's suppose the bubble formation rate is less than that. I mean, Andy was telling me a case, maybe it's less, in which case maybe this wouldn't work. But if you had this sequence, then it's sort of an exponentially growing sequence, and if you want to get finite results, in some sense it seems like you have to cut it off at some point. So my regularization would be effectively to cut it off here. It would say the new bubble formation, that's a new part, so we just include that, but because we cut it off here, we include both this and this, or I can cut it off here, it doesn't matter. If I cut it off here, but then I've got this dominating this. And it seems to be that Vilenkin's would be cutting it off after here. So in some sense you're saying, well, whenever you have bubble formation, then you at least go past the bubbles enough for ordinary observers to form, but not for the BBs to form. So that's the part that seems, I mean, I'm just not terribly convinced by, maybe this is right. I mean, certainly, as Linde emphasizes, he's saying, well, you know, if you get a result that's clearly in conflict with observation, and my way of doing it isn't in conflict, well, whose is better? Well, I agree, his fits observations better, but I guess I'm trying to say it doesn't seem to me that any of these are terribly natural. And so I'm partly posing this problem to stimulate more work to see, can somebody really find a natural way that avoids the BB problem? I'm not saying the BB problem is necessarily occurs at all, because, I mean, certainly there are ways here in which it doesn't happen, but I'm not terribly happy with these things. I mean, I think more work needs to be done, and this BB problem is something you have to take into account when you do try to get the right way.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
Did I miss a term somewhere such that as the universe expands, the energy density is going down, and so the BB formation rate must be going down too with some power fluctuations?
Well, no, because I'm assuming that now this might be a it might be a little different from the original Boltzmann brain, which might be a thermal fluctuation. I'm assuming that Boltzmann brains are vacuum fluctuations, or it can be produced by vacuum fluctuation. In other words, I'm assuming that suppose at a moment of time you could have matter appear in the form with all the details of a brain, or at least of enough details to give consciousness, and the antimatter would be somewhere else. I mean, it might be an anti-brain that doesn't have to be. And then of course just a moment later these things recombine. I mean, in other words, it's like electron positron pair, not production. It's like electron positron virtual production, that for a moment of time the electron exists and the positron exists. Except now I'm imagining what exists is not something so simple as an electron and positron. For what exists for a very tiny moment of time is a brain. So therefore I'm assuming that can happen even in otherwise empty space. So no matter how low the energy density is, it can still happen. You know, you might, I guess another way I might state the thing is to say that I'm assuming that the measure for having an observer in some region of space-time is given by the expectation value of some positive operator that's localized to this region. And then it's the claim, I don't know, maybe I haven't really found a rigorous mathematical proof of this, but there probably exists one, that no matter what state you have, if it's over an infinite volume region, that any positive operator which is confined to some finite region will have a positive expectation value. That in other words, you can always have a fluctuation so that you produce in this region something to make that operator, let's say a projection operator onto a brain state, have a positive expectation value.
So it's simply proportional to the volume.
Well, at least if the volume is big enough compared to the size where this brain has to be. I mean, I am probably assuming that it's, yeah, you have to take
something like uniform local probability density, and then the total number of these things can go 100 to 1.
Right. Yes?
There's something about this that I don't really understand, and maybe it's just me, but so if I was to talk about the probability of forming an electron-positron pair, a virtual pair,
right,
that doesn't seem like a question that has any real meaning, because in the vacuum, it won't do anything. It doesn't attach to anything. I can't observe it. If I have a particle going through, I have to sum it with all the other amplitudes of anything else happening. It seems like I can attach a meaning to, say, Hawking radiation producing a brain, and that would happen, but because the Hawking temperature is it's going to happen at some real rate. But I don't know what the production rate for an off-shell brain means, because I don't know what it means to have an off-shell brain or not.
Well, I suppose you just say, it does assume, I mean, another way out of this, and I have mentioned in earlier papers, is that another way is that we are not finite creatures, we're infinite. And we extend over the whole universe, and you need an operator that extends over the whole universe. For example, the electric charge operator. Electric charge operator, suppose it's a finite volume universe, and you take, and it's neutral. The charge is, it's an eigenstate of charge of zero eigenvalue. Then if you have the electric charge operator extending over the whole universe, then the probability would be exactly zero that this would give you any result different from zero. But what I'm now saying is I'm asking for the probability of something happening in a finite region. So you could ask, in the electron-positron pair production thing, you could say, suppose I have a finite region, and I ask for the charge within that region. And then you could do a quantum calculation as to what's the probability distribution of giving different values of the charge within that region. Now it might... I don't even know if that's finite. It might diverge because of the area. You might have lots of pairs produced with one pair inside the surface and the other outside. So I'm not even... But if you probably regular... I don't know. There probably must be some way of smoothing it off that you could even avoid an infinite answer there. So it's sort of... It's analogous to saying, you know, you have the electron-positron pair, so the electron's here and the positron's there. So you're asking, in a given region, what's the probability of having an electron with no positron? That would be but in this case, of course, it's what's the probability I have a brain in this region. And I don't care what...
Matter on shell, they'll come back together and annihilate and disappear. You know?
Right, right.
A little loop that gets contributed to the total phase and gets factored out.
But isn't that stuff that only works in isn't some infinite scattering theory
limit?
No,
not necessarily. I mean, you know.
That's what you're trying to say.
No,
well, I'm saying it disappears.
It's
sort of
the infinite scattering theory.
No, but
these are real as anything else.
No, I don't know. That's what I'm questioning. I don't know. I mean, maybe the Voigtful ranks only appear in quantum loops and they dream the cosmological constant array, but, you know, otherwise don't affect anything else.
Well, I'm not denying that maybe in an S matrix viewpoint they just create loops and do whatever they do for the S matrix, that they don't survive in the final states because they're off shell. But what I am disputing is the claim that just because they last for some finite time, it means they aren't real. I mean, I don't believe that on this Earth, at least, I'm going to last for an infinite time. But I do believe I'm real. So, if from an S-matrix point, I might be just some loop that's in
Do you believe that you're a random fluctuation?
Well, probably not. But
everyone believes we are, at least if you take quantum fluctuations from inflation.
I don't know.
Yeah, maybe in that sense, right? It depends what you mean by random. Yeah, yeah. I mean, in that sense, I mean, it could arrive from randomness in that sense.
But delay the UI anyway. I want to be a devil's advocate. My
right.
problem is that if I put a point, you know, if being liking to be a devil's advocate, I don't know what I would, with this kind of argument of reality of the Boltzmann brain, whether I would be supporting a religious or an anti-religious statement. Namely, can you create consciousness just like that?
Well, okay, I'm implicitly...
I know what it assumes. I don't care about the assumption, I'm just making...
I mean, I guess for that point, I'm making the assumption, which I don't know is in fact, that consciousness sort of supervenes upon a physical state. In other words, if I could produce a brain that's in the same physical state as my brain, then I believe it would be conscious.
Your statement is simply that you have enough information to describe it, and that is what you would produce.
So I'm just looking for that information. In other words, if this brain appears, even if it's going to disappear, I guess what I'm saying is, you know, quantitatively, you might say, well, my brain lasts for, you know, maybe 70 years, maybe if you have 10, if you're awake two-thirds of the time and 10 observations a second, then roughly 10, 15 billion observations for a human. So that is a lot more than maybe this Boltzmann brain, which maybe just makes one before it disappears. But qualitatively, I'm not quite sure what the difference. If we don't last infinitely long, we're some sort of internal process in the whole system of the universe. And if we're real, and it would seem to me that this Boltzmann brain could be real, I mean, it's lasting also only a finite time. It's shorter, but I don't see a huge qualitative difference between one observation and 15 billion observations. That's the attitude I'm taking here. It doesn't have to last forever to be an observer.
So, actually, Don, let me check in with you about time. I know we've taken most of it with our questions, but it's been about an hour.
I've got one more chance.
Oh, okay.
I have one more transparency.
So why don't you
finish up and then
wrap
we can
up, and then I think lots of us will want to stay.
Right, right.
Continue the conversation, but in case people, some of us are on their way somewhere else.
Okay. Well, this is just sort of more amusing implications if it were right, which may not be. But okay, since it's astronomical decay rate suggested by one way of regularizing it, and since it's not completely ruled out, maybe doubtful. Perhaps you should take it serious one possibility, though it's certainly not the only one. I mean, I agree, there's plenty. So if ordinary observers could last until engulfed by a bubble, suppose we happen to be unlucky enough that a bubble actually hit us, what would happen? Well, we couldn't see it coming, so we wouldn't dread it. I mean, I hope I don't mean cause you to dread it.
Unless we're physicists.
And they'd be destroyed so fast it would feel no pain. There wouldn't be any time for any signals to get up your brains because it would be destroyed at the speed of light. There would be no grieving survivors left behind. Everybody would get destroyed with you. So in that way, it'd be the most humanely possible execution. So furthermore, I suppose the universe, we're always persistent some decreasing fraction or measure of Everett worlds. If the decay, it's reducing the fraction. But that would, so you could never absolutely rule out a decaying universe by observations at any finite time, though at sufficiently many times, observations would be strong statistical evidence against it. Just like I said, I would say that I'm quite confident that the decay rate is not more than 1,000 times its minimum, because statistically we could be here, but we'd be much more likely to be earlier. Anyway, so to finally conclude, it's not the main point's not to say that this is necessarily going to happen, the universe is going to decay, but it's to stimulate more research into this huge mystery of the measure for the string landscape or other multiverse theory. I'm saying there are people have potential solutions out. None of them seem overly simple or natural to me.
and some ones that seem moderately simple, like mine, I wouldn't say mine's all that simple, but give bad results. And so this is, in some sense, this is another criterion that you should use in picking out good ones from bad ones. So, okay, so I think they're all stopped.
Okay, more questions to there. So, okay, actually.
So can BBs repeat the same thoughts?
Well, I suppose they could.
I mean, not the same brain to repeat itself. I mean, you can other brains to have the same thought.
Well, presumably, I mean, if just to take example, if there were an infinite number of these, then presumably they would have all possible brain configurations, you know, would exist.
So by ergodicity, then the probability of particular BBT given some say GGC galaxy correlation function, it can be finite. It doesn't have to be zero.
Right. I'm just saying it would. Yeah, I wouldn't believe that it would be zero. I'm just saying I believe it would be very tiny. In other words, of course, I don't know how to calculate for. Suppose I consider the class of brains that at least think they know what the galaxy-galaxy correlation function is. So it may be an illusion, but at least they think that. That out of that tiny fraction of all brains, there will be some smaller fraction that think they know what it is, and they think that it's in some way it agrees with what we see it to be. Then I'm saying that what we see it to be, it seems to have enough structure to it that I highly suspect that would be a very tiny fraction of the brains that think they see it in some form or another. I mean, I guess to put it another way, there might be some tiny fraction of Boltzmann brains that have part of my present perception, which is, for example, seeing Steve Carlin there. But then also my perception, I have a memory of having seen Steve Carlup at lunch, and the more vague memory, but a memory of having seen him many times in the past many years, and also Andy and stuff. And I guess what I would say, I would find it would seem to be very unlikely that even if I selected the fraction of Boltzmann brains in which an observation, in which part of what the brain's aware of, is the present perception is what I interpret as presently seeing Steve Carlup's image in my brain. Out of that, only a very tiny fraction, I would think, would have the perception of also having a memory of a person looking very similar, and so on and so on. So, in other words, because all of these things, presumably, for a given mass, let's suppose the actions is set by the mass and the size. So, let's suppose the action is set by the mass and size, because it's basically the mass and size. So, for a given mass and size, then each microstate will be equally probable. And so out of those microstates, I'm just saying the fraction of microstates that have some structure may be very tiny. If you ask for additional structure, the fraction is going to be even much tinier yet. So if you conditionalize upon part of the structure, the conditional probability to have the additional structure would be very, very tiny. That's my point as to why I think our observations rule out statistically the chance that we are actual Boltzmann brains.
Well, I want to go back to a question I asked earlier, but I'll ask another one first, because that's important. But why can't I use this to prove that humans will never colonize the galaxy? For example, if we go and colonize the galaxy, our population will grow enormously, the amount of humans at any given time will grow exponentially, and therefore the probability that I am a human that exists if selected at random will be during a galaxy colonized age is practically one. The chance that I'm here as I am now is basically nothing. Why is that different from the Boltzmann brains dominating?
Yeah, it's a fairly, I mean, you know, quantitatively it may be a bit different because you don't necessarily have infinite number on theirs,
sure.
But if you had a big enough finite number, then I would say that I think that the similar argument, in fact, that argument's been made. It's basically a galactic form of Carter's doomsday argument. I think it would be against that, and I do believe that's likely true. That the probability of us colonizing the galaxy is probably very tiny. And I mean, you might say, why is that so? I mean, I don't know. I thought a little bit about why could it be so that we don't colonize the galaxy, and maybe we don't live long enough to do it, or it could be that the colonization of the galaxy could occur, but it might be more likely to occur by robots that aren't conscious. And so maybe the robots, they don't see any need to take humans along, and so...
Also, maybe this other thing, it's just a freak occurrence, and maybe it's related to the fact that, you know, you found a coincidence that, you know, the age of the universe is 100 million years, but divided by the fine structure constant. As an example of that point of view, I would offer one following statement.
Okay.
A probability to find a Chinese in Belgrade 50 years ago was practically zero. Not anymore. What I'm trying to say is that, you know, given time and means, people go around and mix.
Right.
Now, actually, probability to find a Chinese in Belgrade in Yugoslavia is actually not so small anymore.
Are they OOs or BBs?
That I'm not sure, but they're certainly there. And you know, and likewise, you know, people mix and match, and maybe given time and technology, it can even happen. So I'm not sure what that goes for the doomsday argument, nevertheless, but still, you know.
Yeah, so I don't know. I guess, I mean, now the doomsday argument, admittedly, I mean, all of these things, they adjust your prior. So if you were, you know, if you started with a prior, you're absolutely certain the humans were going to do this, then you, no amount of evidence can adjust you from it. I mean, if you start with absolute certainty, then you're never going to learn anything from observations about this. So it doesn't prove anything, but I am pretty sympathetic, you know, to these arguments. And I guess I do say personally, I guess I would find it. I would find it pretty likely that we won't colonize the galaxy, or if we do, that the measure is very tight. Yes.
And excuse me for coming in late, so I missed the whole context. But I was struck by one thing you said. You said, "Well, that robots don't have consciousness." I'm reminded of my favorite quote that I came across in the last year from Thomas Hobbes, who didn't really think much of metaphysics. So he said, hearing Walking Hard had to say, he said, "I think, therefore, matter is capable of thought."
Right.
And I don't see how you can rule that out. So robots are matter. If they're sufficiently complex, they have sufficiently fine-grained sensors. Why aren't they capable of thought? You know?
I can't.
In other words, so there's only a model of consciousness. Just follows from a physical phenomenon, right? Why not? So how's the special about your consciousness?
Yeah, I can't rule it, but I think my argument with that is I think there is a common belief that if you get some object like a robot or a computer that's as complex as humans, that consciousness will follow. I think that's very similar to the South Sea cargo cults who thought they could reproduce some aspects and airplanes would land. They saw that people came in during World War II and they put conning towers up and airplanes landed. So they figured, well, that was the essential point of getting airplanes landed. You put up these conning towers and the airplanes land. I think we know so little about consciousness that it's a simple naivety to assume that once we have robots or computers as complex as humans that they'll be conscious.
Are you saying that there's something intrinsically different about humans from other forms of matter?
Well, I'm saying there could be. I mean, certainly we're made of different material. I mean, most robots now. I mean, I'm not saying. I will say that I believe it's very likely if you actually constructed something made out of exactly the same material as a human brain and exactly the same structure. I would believe that that would be conscious. But if you try to make it out of, say, metal and silicon trips, that's different, so we don't know. And so I would guess it likely isn't conscious.
So I don't think we have enough expertise in the room to answer that question. But Damien, I want to hear Damien's first question addressed, which there might be expertise in here.
So my first question was, sorry to keep having on about this, but it was going back to this matter of off-shell. So I know that Andy says, you know, we're not in this real scattering experiment where we leave everything for infinite time.
Right.
And I'd agree with that, but if we're looking at really, really short time limits, then we're talking, there really isn't a sense in which I can say Boltzmann brains exist. When I write down my Feynman diagrams in field theory, I'm writing them down as one possibility, and they're superposing with an electron-positron pair and with a lot of other junk that I can write down within one particular theory. So I still don't understand, in the sense of writing it down in a Feynman diagram, what it means for a Boltzmann brain to exist rather than
I'm not sure Feynman diagrams are, if you back off of scattering theory, I'm not sure what's left to do with Feynman diagrams. I mean, imagine you're solving the Schrodinger equation.
Okay.
The universe is chugging along and quantum states are evolving and there's some probability. You have a projection operator onto a brain or
Okay.
Something simpler, like
okay,
whatever.
Okay.
Or maybe another way to say
it is. It is possible in a sense, okay, so we are not solving simple perturbative problem, but a complicated perturbative problem with a lot of dressing. So your states are dirty, there, you know, some resonance is pounding, some complicated analog or Lippmann Schwinger equation or whatever.
Right, so it's.
So, you know, maybe I sort of think if you define the brain and intelligence as a sort of, you know, just information context organized in a certain way, maybe it's possible to imagine a very complicated system forming in a way that is describable by something like a scattering process. As long as that does not destroy or make the universe as a whole. So maybe it should be acceptable for an individual Boltzmann popping in and out. You know, long-lived resonance, or maybe not so long. I mean, after all.
Right.
You can think of black hole in some sense. You know.
Yeah.
But then there is a question that I certainly don't understand, which is when you have proliferation of such things.
When you have what, sorry?
Proliferation of many such things.
Okay.
Then
well,
that's
just non-perturbative. So then it's just not a perturbative.
That's not right. Then I would completely agree. That's just, you know.
So maybe there's another way to analyze.
Quantum cosmology. How do you describe the creation of the universe up to nothing? I don't know.
But see, this other thing, that's, I mean, suppose you said at one time, you want to get all the matter in this one region to be just like a human brain. So, and then, well, you have a number of possibilities there, but suppose you just choose some other possibility. Then you just do the path integral. I mean, suppose you do know what the boundary conditions are, your path integral. You do a path integral, it ends at that point. It's not an S matrix, so you don't take the path integral off to infinity, but you take it up to that point, and then just do the path integral, and that and then that should give you the amplitude for getting this, and then you take the absolute square, it would give the measure for getting this. So, I mean, maybe that's not Feynman diagrams because it doesn't go off to infinity, but it's path integrals. It's close to it.
But is that non-zero if you're in an overall state in which the energy density is very near zero? Is that that's the problem? I mean, a Feynman a path integral like that in which you're ending at a final state that has a finite energy.
But I'm not ending it on an energy eigenstate. I'm ending it on some brain configuration. So I have a brain configuration. So it's not an eigenstate of energy. So there's going to be some amplitude for even the zero energy state to have that. I mean, analogously to the harmonic oscillator, I can get an amplitude to be up here even if it's in the ground state because that position is not an energy eigenstate. Yes.
So why do you worry about the very low probability of OOTs, ordinary observer theories? So at this current stage, we the OOs are definitely dominant over BBs, right? The BB theories will not affect OO theories. And then if we go long enough, say all OOs are dead, then BBs dominate, then you don't need to care about any O theories being dominated by BB theories because there's no O's there at that time.
Well, by a theory here, I meant a theory of the entire universe, the all and everything. So I don't have one theory for one time when O is dominated, another theory for another time when BB dominates. A theory, I mean, is a theory for the whole thing. So I'm just saying, if I have a theory such that the whole thing, the BBs dominate, then it makes our observations very unusual. We're very atypical. So I'm saying that counts as a tiny likelihood of our observations given that theory for the whole thing. So then I would say that's evidence against that theory for the whole thing. But it's a theory for the whole thing. It's not a theory for one little piece of the universe.
But at every time epoch, there's no big problem at all.
Okay, but we're
choosing a new measure.
But I guess what I'm saying is we'd like a theory for the whole universe, not just a theory for just now. And not, you know, not just a theory that just applies at this time. Because even if you had it, you'd have to say in the theory, what do you mean by this time? I don't know. It seemed to be hard to have a theory that just applies to this time. I want a theory for the whole thing.
If you have an infinite amount of time, then of course you could every now and then get a fluctuation that looks like our, you know, Big Bang.
The whole works.
Right.
Starting from, you know, our Big Bang type concept. And so this could be repeating, I don't know how often or what the probability would be, but if we've been around, if this situation or, you know, space has been around long enough, you know, we could just be just at the right epoch in one of these many Big Bangs that have occurred throughout this long epoch. And maybe that's very improbable by some measure, but
yeah, I mean that's that is to make sure the just make sure your theory has a measure so the predictions are what we really see.
Right, that's sort of what I'm trying to say. Yeah.
And this is the threat. The bolts and brains are the threat. And when you analyze your theory, it may turn out to not predict what you see.
Yeah, I think that's very good. It's a threat. It's something that, I don't know, maybe wasn't pointed out in exactly this way before. It's some criterion that a good theory has to pass. And I'm not saying that there are no good theories that, well, maybe I am almost saying we have no good theories at all yet. I mean, no complete theories. I mean, the partial theories, there are partial theories that avoid this problem. I mean, as I mentioned, Bousseau and Frevogel and Lindy and Vilenkin, they have versions that avoid this problem. I'm not too sure that any of them are the final answer, and I certainly wouldn't say my regularization is the final answer, but I'm saying this is a criterion that any good theory should pass, and so at least I'd like to, you know, put it there. It's got to pass. It's got to fit this, that, and the other, and this is one of the things that should pass.
But I think my paper with Sorbo also passes that we were talking about.
Yeah, but it might well. I have to think a little more about how. I mean, I guess it's a little question. How do you, you know, again, it's a
question. About it, yeah.
Anyway, but that could be one. I'm not saying that doesn't pass it. I'm not completely sure yet. But we'll talk about it.
Maybe a good time to thank Don again.